KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I know the world is looking at images of our city's devastation. I have seen the front lines of the Palisades fire, and it is staggering.
For a fourth day, a patchwork of deadly blazes continues to rage in Los Angeles.
Today is Friday, January 10th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Another major winter storm is sweeping across the country.
It's bringing cold and snow to the south.
If it ends up being 31 degrees and it's freezing rain or sleeting, it could cause huge problems.
And we hear from Secretary Miguel Cardona about his time leading the Education Department.
We spoke about the rough rollout of the federal student aid application.
It was tough for several of those months, but at the end of the day, over 500,000 more students were eligible for aid last year than the previous year.
And anchor Hoda Kotb says goodbye to the Today Show after 17 years.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Biden got another update on the wildfires in California that have destroyed thousands of homes and now claimed at least 11 lives. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, he said he's concerned the death toll could go higher.
Biden said the fires were unbelievably destructive.
It's almost like it's a battle scene.
And he promised the federal government would be there to help California build back better, as he put it. But he acknowledged that he won't be president when that happens. President-elect Trump takes over shepherding the response and recovery from this disaster in just 10 days.
They know every single thing we're doing about the response. My hope is that they will have at least acknowledged we have some significant experience in this. We've done really well on it. I'm praying that they continue to focus.
Biden said Congress will need to approve additional disaster relief funding. Tamara Keith, NPR News, the White House.
President-elect Donald Trump will begin office as a convicted and sentenced felon. More from NPR's Andrew Bernstein.
Trump received no jail time, probation, or fines at his sentencing hearing, just an unconditional discharge after being convicted by a jury of 34 felonies. Trump fought furiously to avoid even that outcome, not wanting the stain of a felony conviction hanging over his presidency. The judge in the case, Juan Merchan, who had himself sentenced Trump's former chief financial officer to jail time, said the constitutional protections of the presidency, bolstered by the Supreme Court's immunity decision last July, meant that this was the only sentence that could be applied to an incoming president. Trump's lawyer, Todd Blanche, whom Trump has nominated for the number two position in the Justice Department, said he hoped, quote, this will never happen again in this country. Blanche says he'll appeal. Andrea Bernstein, NPR News, New York.
More than 200 passengers and crew members aboard a Delta Airlines flight on an Atlanta runway had to evacuate after the engine failed during takeoff. As Matt Sepik of Minnesota Public Radio reports, the FAA is investigating.
Allison Wade of Atlanta was in a window seat on the right side of the Boeing 757-300 when it came to a sudden halt while speeding down the runway. Wade says she looked outside and saw black smoke coming from an engine. Then a flight attendant told everyone to crouch down before the pilot ordered passengers to evacuate down the inflatable slides.
Everybody kind of jumped up and was standing, but it took people a while to move. And then someone started screaming, get off the plane, get off the plane.
Delta Airlines says three passengers were treated for minor injuries and a fourth was taken to a hospital. For NPR News, I'm Matt Sepik in Minneapolis.
Better than expected December jobs numbers apparently weighed on Wall Street. The market's worried the Fed may be less likely to cut rates later this month. The Dow fell 696 points today. You're listening to NPR. Entertainer-turned-anti-gay activist Anita Bryant has died. She was 84. She became an iconic promoter for Florida orange juice in the 1970s. She was later known for opposition to LGBTQ rights. NPR's Walter Ray Watson has more.
Anita Bryant's public career and national attention began when she was Miss Oklahoma in the 1959 Miss America pageant. She then released this pop single. Paper Roses was a hit in 1960. By the early 1970s, she became the pitch woman for the Florida Citrus Commission.
Come to the Florida sunshine tree.
Bryant later gained national prominence, leading efforts to overturn a local ordinance in Florida protecting some LGBTQ rights. but her activism mobilized the gay community around the country to boycott Florida orange juice. Bryant eventually lost sponsors and money, but she was unwavering in her position. Walter Ray Watson, NPR News.
Baltimore-based Constellation Energy has announced it's buying Calpine Energy, a nearly $16.5 billion deal. The merger joins two of the nation's biggest power companies and the nation's largest nuclear power plant operator. Combined, the companies will have nearly 60 gigawatts of capacity from zero and low-emission sources. Cash and stock deal shows the role electricity generation is expected to play, especially in terms of hungry data centers for AI. Crude oil futures prices moved higher, oil up $2.65 a barrel to $76.57 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at NerviveHealth.com.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. We begin this hour in Los Angeles, where we have been reporting on major fires that broke out this week, with potential new ones on the horizon. Several people have died. Thousands of structures have been lost or damaged. There is still very little containment. For the latest, we are joined by McKenna Sievertson. She's a reporter for LAist and has been following the fires closely all week. Hi, McKenna.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Hey, so I want to start with two of the most destructive fires on our radar, the Eaton and the Palisades fires. Where do those two stand?
Yeah, so the Palisades fire has been burning through the Santa Monica Mountains for a few days now. It's the largest at more than 20,000 acres and still stuck at single digit containment. But I think a lot of folks are just happy to see any containment at all at this point. More than 5,000 structures have been damaged or destroyed in this fire alone. At least two people have died. But unfortunately, all of these numbers are expected to rise as officials and first responders are able to get into these areas. There's also been a significant number of injuries to people who didn't evacuate in time. And officials are calling this one of the most destructive natural disasters in Los Angeles's history. And with the Eaton fire, that is burning near Eaton Canyon in Altadena. It's the second largest at more than 13,000 acres, and it has even less containment at just 3%. And more than 5,000 structures are estimated to be destroyed. Five people have died. There's been several firefighters that are injured. And there's evacuation warnings and orders still in place for both of those fires. And we are still seeing some other impacts as well, including power outages. And some people are being warned to boil their water or use water bottles for cooking and drinking.
Wow. It's just mind-boggling to hear you describe a fire that is 13,000 acres, and it's the second biggest burning right now in L.A. What about their smaller wildfires? I gather quite a few, including some new ones today.
Yeah, so a fire started just a few hours ago in Granada Hills, which is a community in the North San Fernando Valley. And it grew quickly, as all of them have. They've sparked and spread just really quickly. And evacuation orders were issued. It looks like they're starting to get that under control right now. It's not clear what sparked it, but spot fires have started from the embers flying in the air. And this is just one of them. There was another fire that started in the San Fernando Valley community of West Hills yesterday. And that has started push into Ventura County towards the west. And in the Hollywood Hills, the Sunset Fire started near a popular hiking trail, and that's called Runyon Canyon. That was earlier the week on Wednesday night. Evacuation orders started going out within an hour of when that fire was first reported. And some people in West Hollywood were, you know, outside of those evacuation zones, but were spooked enough to leave home anyways. And I'd just like to note that the entire Angeles National Forest, which is 700,000 acres of green space in LA and the neighboring counties, that's closed until early next week because of the critical fire danger.
So, I mean, what is the atmosphere in LA? How are communities that you're visiting, that you're reporting, and how are they responding?
people are scared. I mean, myself included. I grew up here. I'm no stranger to wildfires, but this has been an incredibly challenging time. I think people are anxious. No one expected this amount of devastation, and especially in some of the areas that it burned. But communities are really rallying around each other, and that's kind of been a bright spot, at least for me personally. For example, in Pasadena, where our newsroom is based, a shelter is just overwhelmed with donations. The Humane Society parking lot is overflowing with supplies after taking in animals, and people across the area are just offering up whatever space they have. So the support is there right now when it is so desperately needed.
McKenna Sievertson, she is a reporter for LAist. Thank you so much for bringing us your reporting.
Thank you for having me.
From wildfires in California to winter weather across the South, a winter storm has been dumping snow in areas that just aren't used to it. It's caused traffic problems, power outages, and a lot of cancellations, schools, flights. With us now from Atlanta is Rahul Bali of WABE. Hi there.
Hey.
So, Rahul, tell us what it's like where you are. What have you been dealing with today?
You know, Juana, for days, emergency officials warn folks, stay home, stay off the road starting this morning. And generally, most people have. The vast majority of schools, businesses, government offices are closed. There still have been some issues on the roads in North Georgia. For those who tried to brave the slick roads, the biggest danger has been spinouts. You know, I've seen law enforcement posting pictures of some of those crashes in the hopes that people will stay off the roads. There was a major accident this morning involving 8 tractor trailers on an interstate interchange curve. I've driven it. It's tough even when it's dry. There's also been challenges for airports across the South, including here in Atlanta. According to FlightAware, there's already been 1,000 flight cancellations here. That's approaching half the scheduled flights at the world's busiest airport. There's also been ground stops at the Atlanta airport. This is going to have ripple effects across the country. Remember, Delta has a hub here. It's also a key city for other airlines like Southwest.
Right. Well, we've been hearing officials saying that they have been well prepared for the storm in Georgia. Tell us what they did to get ready.
So officials and even some journalists have been reminding folks of the infamous 2014 winter storm. Around here, it's nicknamed Snowmageddon, and thousands of people ended up stranded on Atlanta highways and streets as the slick roads froze right under their cars. People abandoned their cars, walked along the highways. During a press conference of state leaders today, before reporters could even ask, the head of emergency management in Georgia, Chris Stallings, compared what is happening now to then.
Biggest thing is that we have learned a lot of lessons, so we've stayed in front of it. We've not allowed the disabled vehicles to stay stranded on the roadway. We are getting reports of those, but we're being extremely proactive to ensure that we're getting those out of the way.
And again, it's really been about seeing spinouts and just only a handful of cars stuck on the side of the road.
I understand that temperatures are expected to drop again into the evening. So tell us what officials are looking out for. I presume ice might be an issue.
This is really all about what happens to the snow that's on the ground, on cars, on any kind of surface. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, during that same press conference, he called it a fine line as temperatures have hovered around 32 degrees all day.
If it ends up being 31 degrees and it's freezing rain or sleeting, it could cause huge problems on our roadways, but also with power outages.
And this winter storm has caused power outages across the South. Arkansas had at least 34,000 today, sporadic outages in Texas and in other states.
I imagine that snow is rare in Atlanta, and I can't help thinking about the kids with those schools closed all day. What have these kids been out there doing?
So our family heeded the warnings. We've all stayed home. And I live on one of the steeper hills in my neighborhood. So kids and adults have been sliding down the street on whatever they can. And you might hear that in the background. You know, we don't get much snow here, so we don't have snowboards. We don't have snow tubes. Basically, people like my kids were using things from the swimming pool, like floats and inner tubes, to slide down the hill because that's all we have.
Sounds like fun. That's Rahul Bali with WABE in Atlanta. Thank you.
No problem.
Okay, some non-weather news. The U.S. prison population has been rising in recent years. That's after more than a decade of decline. As NPR's Meg Anderson reports, experts are warning the number of people in prisons may keep going up amid a growing shift among states toward tough-on-crime laws.
After George Floyd was murdered by a Minneapolis police officer in 2020, communities around the country took a hard look in the mirror. Many cities and states created new measures to curb police violence, scaled back long prison sentences, and enacted bail reform. Rachel Barkow, a law professor at New York University, says it was a turning point in the criminal justice reform movement.
And I think there was a backlash to that.
Around the same time, crime went up. Researchers stress that crime rates rise for complex reasons, but many voters blamed the reforms, and last year, at least half a dozen states stiffened punishments. Louisiana lowered the age someone can be tried as an adult from 18 to 17. Oregon recriminalized drugs it had decriminalized, and California tightened penalties it had loosened for certain theft and drug crimes. Research shows harsher punishments do not deter crime, but Barkow says they do have ripple effects, including increasing the prison population.
Every law that increases sentences or makes prison admissions more likely, all that stuff increases overcrowding. It's not as if prison officials can say, oh, we're full, you know, like a motel, no vacancy.
The prison population has gone up around 2% since 2022, and many prisons are already overcrowded and understaffed. That combination can lead to more violence, burnt out employees, and worse health care for prisoners. Matthew Charles is with the group FAM, a criminal justice reform nonprofit. He served more than 20 years in four different federal prisons. He says medical appointments, education classes, and family visits were all canceled when there weren't enough staff. In his experience,
we don't really believe in rehabilitation anymore. We just believe in incapacitation, meaning we're going to warehouse you for a specific period of time, and we don't care if you get better or worse while you're behind bars.
A Federal Bureau of Prisons spokesperson said in a statement the agency is committed to quality medical care and a safe environment. Charles was released in 2019. Like him, most prisoners go home. So he says when they do, you want them to be productive members of their communities. Meg Anderson, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. The last 4 years have been rocky for the Department of Education. K through 12 students who returned to school after pandemic closure suffered record levels of learning loss and have not yet recovered. Many are still absent a lot. A disastrous rollout for last year's FAFSA, that's the free application for federal student aid, actually hurt some of the low-income students the new form was intended to help. And the courts have struck down affirmative action in college applications, and they've blocked the Biden administration's sweeping plan to forgive student loans for tens of millions of borrowers. Still, there have also been successes. Nearly 5 million Americans have had their student loans forgiven, and this year, FAFSA applicants are having a much smoother experience. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona has led the department through all of those ups and the downs, and he joins me now. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Thanks for being here. Okay, I want to start off by talking about the FAFSA because any parent or student knows just how important that form and that process is for people who are hoping for help paying for college. And you know as well as I do how tough that rollout was for a lot of people last year. I want to start just by asking you to take stock. What do you attribute those shortcomings to?
You know, it's 40 years of stagnant status quo, and we changed it. And I'll be honest with you, it was tough for several of those months. But at the end of the day, over 500,000 more students were eligible for aid last year than the previous year. So in my opinion, it was worth the challenges to get to a system where more kids could have access to higher education. And, you know, and I'm one of those parents. I filled it out last year for my daughter, and I had to fill it out 2 years ago for my son. It was a big difference. And I'm so thankful that this year we have record numbers, and we're proud that moving forward for generations to come, more students are going to have access to federal dollars.
I wonder, from your point of view as a leader, do you believe that your department identified the problems with the FAFSA quickly enough? And once those problems were identified, do you feel like you acted quickly enough once you knew about them to make a fix?
I don't think we identified them soon enough. And quite frankly, Juana, we were dependent on external contractors too much. So when we found out what the issue was, we had to fix it, but we also had to overhaul federal student aid, the group that oversees FAFSA. So we removed some folks, we brought in some new folks, we changed the system to make sure that in the future this never happens again.
In the process of putting together the form of troubleshooting what went wrong, making sure things went better this year, did you have the opportunity to speak with any of the students who were personally affected by all of this, students who were seeking financial support to be able to go to school? I remember hearing from people who were waiting and waiting to know what kind of aid they might receive and didn't find out until much later than they were expecting, and it affected their choices, where they were choosing to go to school.
I did. I actually was out as much as possible, sitting with students who were struggling with it, with their families, to try to get a better sense of the impact of what the decisions that were being made at FSA, how that impacted. There was a student I visited, it was in Arizona, who he was living independently, and the form expected the parents to contribute, yet he couldn't even tell me where his parents were. So I looked at students that had the greatest need. The form wasn't working for them. So we got to work to make sure that we made the changes needed.
Let's turn now to another topic, that of student debt. One of the Education Department's biggest mandates, and this was a big priority of President Joe Biden, was forgiving student loans for tens of millions of people that have them. And as we mentioned, that effort faced opposition in the courts. It failed. Are there ways you wish you'd approach that differently?
You know, we work really hard to try to fix a broken loan system. And I believe we were successful in many ways, but I do believe that unfortunately the courts and some of our Republican friends really were set against any type of debt relief, despite not posing so much opposition when we're bailing out the airline industry or when we're bailing out the auto industry or the banks. But when it's their constituents, that's when they wanted to speak out against government supporting and fixing a system that was broken.
Do you have any regrets about the amount of energy and manpower that education departments spent pursuing such broad student loan forgiveness, which meant that if you're pouring a lot of attention into that bucket, that means attention was diverted away from other things that the agency might have been able to do.
No, because, you know, we went after those schools that preyed on first-generation college students or veterans. We did a lot of work to fix a system that was broken. And right now, today, one out of every eight students with, or borrowers with student loan debt has had their loans forgiven. I still get texts from people who know someone whose, you know, loans were forgiven because they're a public servant or because their school was found to be liable of cheating them. So there are 5 million people across the country whose lives are different now, and their children's lives are different because of the work that we did around debt forgiveness.
I want to turn now to the K-12 level. We know that students who endured pandemic closures, they've made some progress, but there's still a significant achievement gap. I know that you spent decades in public schools in the state of Connecticut, both as a teacher and an administrator. As you think back to that time in your own experience, if you were still in those roles, what kind of support would you want from the Department of Education to help those students in classrooms who are still dealing with that learning loss?
Quite frankly, Juana, you know, I've been Secretary of Education for 4 years, and it's such an honor to be in this role. But I've been a public school educator for my whole career, over 27 years. They need additional reading support, which is why we fought for Title I funding. They need mental health support, which is why under the Biden-Harris administration, we have 16,000 more school social workers, psychologists, pathways to careers, and not just four-year colleges, right? I was a tech school graduate, Juana, and I know that so many of our students need a pathway into the labor, and getting credentials might be a better way of doing it for them. So we've increased career technical education programming. As an educator, as a fourth grade teacher, I would want to make sure that the resources from the federal government are focusing on the things that I need, making sure that our local public schools are still great places for all students.
There's also the issue of chronic absenteeism, though. That is something that has been at a crisis level affecting our most vulnerable students in districts big and small across this country. Is there something you might suggest to your successor that might help turn that tide?
Absenteeism is a symptom of something greater, right? When I was a school teacher, kids weren't absent because, as a nine-year-old, they didn't want to be absent. They were absent because they had housing issues. They had transportation issues. They had hunger issues. There were other things that were impacting it. So I would tell the successor to continue to focus on those programs that take care of the whole child. Because when children are well, when they're not hungry, when they know where they're sleeping at night, they're more likely to be able to succeed academically.
Though I imagine some parents who are sitting there in their communities might think the decisions about how my child is educated are best made in my state and my city and my community rather than by the federal government. So if you could just make the case to them, why should the federal government be involved here?
Oh, I totally agree that states should do it. As a matter of fact, the way the system is set up now, Juana, states are doing it. I was a state commissioner of education. I had more say in education in Connecticut than I do as a federal secretary of education. That's how it should be. As a matter of fact, the local boards should be the ones making a lot of the decisions. So, you know, to assume that the federal government has an outsized role is false. And I think, you know, that's part of the rhetoric that is misinformation. I do believe, you know, school choice should be a part of a parent's look. I'm a product of school choice. I went to a high school that was technical. I didn't go to my local neighborhood high school. I'm a total believer in that. And I think a lot of the misinformation has people thinking that the federal government has a bigger role. You know, we fund 9% of public education. 91% of it is state and local, and that's how it should stay. And I do agree that decisions at curriculum should be made at the local level, not at the federal level.
Education Secretary for a little bit longer, Miguel Cardona, thank you so much for joining us.
Great talking to you. Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Rusty Savage is back in Scott Turow's latest novel, Presumed Guilty. We asked the novelist why he gave his character a trilogy.
I felt that I owed him more, this character whose career has been synonymous with my own.
That conversation plus the latest on the Southern California wildfires, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, climate scientists attribute what's happening in LA this week to a phenomenon called climate whiplash.
Very much follows a recipe, the delayed onset of winter rains coinciding with one of these strong, widespread Santa Ana wind events.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The Los Angeles fire chief says cuts in the department's budget are hindering the response to deadly wildfires that continue to ravage the county. Chief Kristen Crowley says she warned the city last month against reducing critical resources.
I have also requested multiple budgets, interim budgets, to show how understaffed, under-resourced, and underfunded the LAFD is. So with that, also, we have clear data that shows the LAFD needs more help.
The death toll from the massive wildfires has risen to at least 11 in LA County. More than 10,000 structures have been destroyed and entire neighborhoods reduced to ashes. Forecasters say powerful winds and dry conditions are expected to further complicate efforts to contain the blazes into next week. The U.S. Supreme Court appears to have signaled that it will uphold a law that would ban the video sharing app TikTok in the United States. The platform is appealing the law signed by President Biden last year that would force TikTok's Chinese-based parent company to divest by January 19th or face a ban. NPR's Bobby Allen reports there are a number of arguments both for and against keeping the site running in the U.S.
All the justices appeared pretty skeptical that TikTok's free speech rights are more important than overseas threats. Some worried that TikTok could collect personal information on teenage users who, as adults, might work in the military or the federal government. Then the information could be used against them as blackmail. Other justices voiced concerns about China pushing propaganda on the app.
That's NPR's Bobby Allen reporting. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Winter storm warnings have been posted across large parts of the United States. The National Weather Service says severe weather is expected from the Texas Panhandle to parts of the Atlantic coast. Tens of thousands of customers remain without power in Texas and Arkansas. Officials in Georgia are warning residents to expect a mixture of snow, sleet, freezing rain, and ice. Incoming U.S. envoy to the Middle East, Steve Witkoff, has arrived in Doha to assist with talks about a ceasefire in Gaza. That's according to officials in Qatar. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports Witkoff will serve under President-elect Donald Trump.
Witkoff was received by the Qatari Prime Minister, according to a statement from Qatar. They talked about the latest developments in the region, particularly about a ceasefire deal in Gaza that would release some Israeli hostages in exchange for Palestinian prisoners and detainees. Mediators have been in talks in Doha about a ceasefire for many days now. Earlier this week, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that a deal was, quote, very close. In an interview with Israeli TV News, Witkoff said that the release of hostages is, quote, Trump's most important mission before taking office. Witkoff has also said that he's hopeful for a, quote, good announcement about the deal by Trump's inauguration later this month. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
At the close on Wall Street, the Dow was down 696 points. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from C3 AI, C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to traceable, hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. This is Enterprise AI. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The wildfires in Los Angeles are just the latest in a series of devastating fires across the state. You may recall the 2018 Camp Fire in Paradise, California. Scientists say this is part of a trend in the West, one that is fueled in part by human-caused climate change. Here to explain, we have Ezra David Romero, climate reporter with KQED in San Francisco. Hey there.
Hey there.
So explain away, how is climate change playing into what we're watching in LA this week?
Well, basically, as the atmosphere warms, it's able to hold more water. And it has these two big effects. First, it has longer dry periods and then very wet periods, because when it does rain, there's so much more water available. So during those wet periods, we see rapid growth in fuels, things like the grass, brush, and trees. And then if a dry period follows, then all that moisture gets sucked out, leaving the fuel super ready to burn. And climate scientists call this hydroclimate whiplash. I know it's a nerdy term, but it basically means rapid swings between super wet and super dry conditions. And new research out this week cements this idea that climate change is making this whiplash even worse.
So hydroclimate whiplash is what you said scientists are calling it. Is that what is happening in LA?
Yeah, the LA fires are sort of this perfect example of short-range hydroclimate whiplash. You know, we had two crazy winters of major wet weather causing major flooding in parts of Southern California. Then it's been pretty not rainy since then. And on top of that, last summer was really, really hot. All those grasses that grew in that wet period sort of all dried out. And this sort of all created the perfect conditions for wildfires to grow out of control. And then on top of all of this, we had extremely strong Santa Ana winds. You know, we always get those in Southern California at this time of year, but this time they were incredibly strong. I spoke to UC Merced climatologist John Abatsoglu about this.
The delayed onset of winter rains coinciding with one of these strong and widespread Santa Ana wind events seems like that is the recipe for many of the catastrophic fires that we've seen in Southern California.
Yeah, and I should say that as for the winds themselves, scientists are studying it, but we don't have evidence right now that climate change is making them any worse.
Huh. Well, that gets, I guess, to my central question. I understand it's complex, but can we say cause-effect? Can we say climate change caused these fires?
Not exactly. You know, climate change is one of the factors at play, but it's hard to say exactly how much. UC Berkeley climate physics professor David Romp says California's always had these big swings between wet and dry conditions.
It's hard to say to what extent the amped up whiplash from climate change is quote unquote responsible for the fires going on in LA right now, but it's consistent with the kind of increase in this variability we expect to see.
So climate change is making the conditions that could lead to a wildfire more likely, but there are a lot of other factors, right? Like so many people live near these wildland areas, like in Los Angeles County. And then we have these historical decisions like suppressing wildfires. But ultimately, scientists expect climate change to deepen this idea of hydroclimate whiplash as long as we're burning fossil fuels and adding carbon to the atmosphere.
Mm. So just briefly, it sounds like what we can expect for California, for the West, is wildfires will continue and they may well be getting larger and more destructive?
Yeah, exactly. We might see more of what's happening in Los Angeles over and over again.
Ezra David Romero from KQED in San Francisco. Thank you, Ezra.
Thanks for having me.
In southern Ukraine, the riverside city of Kherson is a coveted prize for Russia. Russian troops shell neighborhoods daily and send drones buzzing over the streets. NPR's Brian Mann spent time with one team of Ukrainian soldiers working under cover of darkness to disrupt Russian attacks.
At dusk, an armored vehicle takes me along a rutted farm road near Kherson, a few miles from the bank of the Dnipro River. A Ukrainian soldier guided me here after NPR agreed not to reveal the exact location.
I'm Brian.
Yuri.
Yuri, good to see you. Good to see you, Vitaly.
In the early winter darkness, I meet a small unit of soldiers, middle-aged men mostly in green wool caps and gloves and worn combat fatigues.
They're pulling back the camouflage netting, and we're in a kind of half trench here that's dug back into a forested hillside. And as they pull up the curtain, there's an enormous armored vehicle here hidden away.
The unit's leader is a burly guy who goes by the military call sign Grizzly. Keeping real names secret is common protocol for Ukrainian soldiers. NPR has agreed to use only their first names or nicknames for security reasons. Grizzly tells me by day they keep their weapons carefully hidden from enemy drones and artillery.
Can I come up?
Yes.
I climb up onto the steel deck of what looks at first like a tank. In fact, it's part armored troop carrier, part mobile artillery. Grizzly tells me it's a Soviet-era weapon system modernized by Ukrainian engineers with a better gun, a kind of machine gun cannon, and better electronics for targeting and navigation in darkness. It performs really well, Grizzly says. It's fast and maneuverable. It's also deadly. Yuri, the team's gunner, digs through a box of shells, each one longer than my hand. They're chained together so they can be fed quickly into the cannon. We work fast, Yuri tells me. We arrive at the river and we fire, emptying the gun in a minute and a half at most. Then I tell the driver, let's get out of here. These kind of hit-and-run tactics are designed to harass the Russians and keep them off balance. But Ukrainian units like this one, with the 1st Battalion of the 40th Coastal Defense Brigade, are dangerously outnumbered. They've been ordered to defend big sections of the Dnipro riverbank. I put the question to this battalion's commander, who goes by the call sign Kari. Can you hold Kherson? Our job is to destroy the Russians and keep them from advancing and taking more of our territory. And we're getting that done, Kari says. I ask him about a report shared with NPR by a Ukrainian official that Russia may be building up troops and boats for a major amphibious attack near Kherson. We look forward to the Russians trying to attack us. It would give us a chance to destroy more of them, Kari says. It's bold talk, but Kari himself symbolizes how thin Ukraine's army is after years of fighting Russia.
Do you mind if I ask how old you are?
24.
This battalion commander, charged with defending an entire sector of the Dnipro River, is just 24 years old.
You sound confident.
I'm confident in my men, so I'm confident in myself, Kari tells me. It's full dark now. I can see the men's breath in their headlamps as they make final preparations, battening the armored hatches and making ready to roll out. I asked the men with this coastal defense unit if they think they can hold the Dnipro River. Yes, we can hold, Yuri tells me. I don't hear doubts from any of these soldiers about their mission, driving out in darkness, night after night, to face the Russians.
Do you feel nervous?
We've gotten used to it, one of the soldiers says. Another soldier says this is just what we do now. This is our job. Brian Mann, NPR News, near the front lines in Kherson.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This week, the Biden administration announced that a record 24 million people have enrolled in health insurance plans from the Affordable Care Act marketplaces. All of that could change, though, with President-elect Trump taking office later this month. NPR's Selena Simmons-Steffen reports.
If you've heard this before, record enrollment in healthcare.gov and the state marketplaces, that's because there was just a record set last year and the year before.
This year, I was actually expecting the enrollment growth to maybe plateau a bit.
That's Cynthia Cox of KFF, a nonpartisan health research organization. She says the past few years, there were clear reasons for those record numbers, like lower premiums and higher demand because of the COVID pandemic. Nothing big changed this year that would keep pumping up demand.
So I think it's really remarkable that it's continuing to reach new record highs.
This year's record, 24 million people, is a lot. When President Biden took office 4 years ago, it was only 12 million. And that increase has chipped away at the overall number of uninsured people in the U.S. Javier Becerra, Secretary of Health and Human Services, briefed reporters earlier this week.
Today, more than 300 million Americans have health coverage. That's a record number.
White House domestic policy advisor Neera Tanden told reporters on the call, these numbers show that Biden administration policies have worked.
We made the largest investment ever into outreach efforts that help people sign up for health insurance. We've also eliminated bureaucratic red tape. And crucially, we've lowered health insurance premiums.
Now the question is, will any of this last after President Trump takes office? Trump has kept open the possibility of repealing the 14-year-old Affordable Care Act. He said in the presidential debate that he had the concepts of a plan for replacing it. Republicans, who are set to take the majority in both houses of Congress, by and large oppose the ACA. They especially don't like the enhanced federal subsidies from the pandemic era. Many people can now get plans for $10 a month. Those subsidies will expire next December unless Congress extends them. Again, here's Cynthia Cox from KFF.
If I was placing a bet, I would feel much more comfortable betting that the enhanced subsidies will be allowed to expire at the end of this year.
Neither the Trump-Vance transition team nor House Speaker Mike Johnson's office responded to NPR's request for comment. Cox says the only way the ACA boom could continue is if a few Republicans join Democrats in voting to extend the subsidies. And that might happen because...
where you have seen the most growth in ACA signups and also where people are benefiting the most financially actually tends to be in red states.
The biggest growth has been in Texas. In the last 4 years, enrollment there has gone up more than 200%. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. The U.S. is seeking the release of all 7 American hostages held in Gaza and the ongoing negotiations for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. That is more than Hamas has said it was prepared to release in negotiations now. But that is what U.S. Ambassador to Israel Jack Lew is pursuing.
We are going to do everything we can in this round to get all the American hostages living and dead out.
The top U.S. envoy to Israel is leaving his post in a week before President-elect Trump takes office, and the ambassador spoke to NPR today about his role during the war. NPR's Daniel Estrin met him in Jerusalem.
Ambassador Jack Lew is tall. He'd stand out in a crowd. But sitting in the official residence in Jerusalem, he told us why he's kept a low public profile this past year.
I don't think it was a year when being out having dinner and looking like you were on the town was even appropriate. I was here for 15 months of war.
He arrived a month after the October 7th attacks. His first meeting in the official residence was with the families of U.S. citizens taken hostage by Hamas. Today, he met again with U.S. hostage families. A photo of American hostage Idan Alexander sits on his shelf.
His grandmother gave me that picture and asked me to keep it prominent. And, you know, I can do everything I can in the diplomatic channel, but I can also do it, you know, a young man's grandmother asked me to do.
He's a soldier who would not be released in phase one.
We're trying. We're working hard on his case.
The most high-profile American case was Hirsch Goldberg Polin, a 23-year-old American-Israeli hostage killed by his captors in Gaza last summer. Ambassador Lew confirmed they were negotiating his release in the weeks before he was killed.
The fact that he was brutally murdered in cold blood, while his name is actively in a discussion on the release of hostages, kind of shows you what we're dealing with.
One debate among U.S. diplomats has been the U.S. arming Israel and whether Israel took care to limit civilian casualties in Gaza. Lew says Israel generally met the U.S. military's own standards.
When you're fighting an enemy like Hamas that's deliberately hiding, you know, its munitions and its command and control operations and its military leaders and fighters behind civilians, it takes extraordinary effort to limit civilian casualties.
How to judge the Biden administration's role in the war? Former U.S. Ambassador to Israel Daniel Kurtzer says it was a mixed legacy, but for the majority of the war, U.S. diplomacy failed.
On the one hand, having supported Israel in the response to October 7th, but having failed to constrain the Israeli military in the destructiveness that it wrought on Gaza.
Ambassador Lew says one of his main successes was getting Israel to allow aid into Gaza.
You heard people saying, not a drop of water, not a drop of milk, not a drop of oil goes into Gaza. So we took what was a closed system that was impenetrable, and through daily, you know, engagement, achieved opening up the system.
He said he worked hard to avoid any public rift with Israel, but said he sometimes didn't get the same treatment in return. Like when the U.S. opposed the negotiated with Israel to restrain its invasion of Rafah.
I bridle a little bit when I hear this simple sort of political slogan, they said we couldn't and we did.
You're speaking about when Prime Minister Netanyahu spoke publicly saying we went into Rafah even though we were pressured not to.
For another week, I'm a diplomat, and I think you understood correctly what I meant, but I'm going to leave it at that.
If he's confirmed, the next ambassador will be former Arkansas governor and evangelical minister Mike Huckabee. He is a close ally of Netanyahu. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Come Monday, daytime TV will look different. That's because today was the last day of anchor Hoda Kotb's time on the Today Show. After 17 years, to send her off, the show aired a special celebration, a Hodabration, they called it. Well, congratulations. And here's NPR's Andrew Limbong.
Let's hold off on the tearful goodbyes and weepy montages for a second. Start with a hello.
From NBC News.
In 2007, NBC expanded its morning flagship show, Today, to a fourth hour.
With Ann Curry, Natalie Morales, and Hoda Kotb.
And, well, she was last billed there that first day. By the next year, Kotb was the star of the show, along with a new co-host, Kathy Lee Gifford. Their first show together was literally them getting to know each other live on the air. Here's Kotb.
I was born in a little town, not little, but called Norman, Oklahoma.
I know Norman, Oklahoma.
Okay, I was born in Norman, Oklahoma, and grew up in Morgantown, West Virginia. Okay. I
haven't been there.
West Virginia. I was
rooted. Is that a steel town?
What? Yes. And okay. It's a coal town. And also,
you can hear them feeling out their dynamic here, one that audiences would come to love for more than a decade, until Gifford left in 2019. But Gifford made a surprise return to the NBC set at this morning's Hodabration to toast Kotb away, with everyone holding impossibly large wine glasses filled close to the top.
I think what I want to send her off with, which is what she knows from my heart means the most to me, is that I'm sending you off with a prayer.
This was the tone for a lot of the broadcast this morning, with tissues being grabbed through special surprise appearances from Gayle King, Jimmy Fallon, Kotb's own mom.
Cody, I'm proud of you.
And of course, Kotb's current co-host, Jenna Bush Hager.
You have taught me to look, really look, into the eyes and the hearts of our guest, and to listen. How to really listen.
This was the special sauce that Kotb brought to the Today Show formula. In 2018, she was promoted to co-anchor the earlier hours of the Today Show alongside Savannah Guthrie. This is after former anchor Matt Lauer got fired following allegations of sexual misconduct. And in that position, Kotb shined as she interviewed people. In her recent interview with TV food personality Ina Garten, Kotb asks her multiple times about Garten's difficult relationship with her mom growing up.
What about hugs and kisses?
No hugs and kisses in my family.
Until Kotb gets enough information to ask this.
How did you know that your mother loved you?
I'm not sure that I did. I don't know that she was capable.
Kotb didn't just ask questions. She revealed a lot about herself on air, her health, her breakup, her adopting two kids. It felt like a two-way street for daytime TV audiences. And so after Kotb ended this morning's broadcast thanking her staff.
And second of all, I want you to look into the eyes of the people who are behind me right now. This is our longtime staff, our incredible crew, our producers. They all came. They're all here.
It was the audience that sent her off with a cheer. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. From Mathnasium, committed to making math fun and building confidence so students can achieve their potential this school year, offering customized math instruction and individual attention to students in grades K through 12. Mathnasium.com. And from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com.